Hello and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast that brings you animal facts, wildlife updates and nature stories from the professionals to you. On this week's show, I spoke with author and manager of the Museum of Zoology at Cambridge University, Jack Ashby. Jack knows his museums well, and it was a pleasure to chat to him about what kind of things we can learn from visiting these rooms of education. It's not just what you read on the signs that can tell you about the animals. From the conservation status, air pollution, and even the taxidermists themselves, there's a huge list of what these animals can be telling us. We also touched on a passion of Jack's, and that's Australian mammals, in particular the platypus and the wombat. I'd like to remind you all, my listeners, that this episode was recorded from a narrowboat in London, so whilst I did my best, I apologise for any background noise. Thanks for joining and enjoy the show. Hi Jack, thanks so much for joining me for this episode on Into the Wild. How are you doing, bud?
Oh, I'm doing very well, thank you. Pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. We won't talk about it too much, but how's lockdown life been for you at the moment?
It's okay. I'm kind of doing my museum work remotely, so that's going well. And then it's quite a nice opportunity to... I'm writing a book about platypuses at the moment.
So amazing.
Rather than commuting in the mornings and evenings, I'm spending a few hours doing that. So that's going... that's kind of a positive way of using my time, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like the most positive use of time I've heard so far. Writing a book about platypuses. It sounds great. So you've been doing something on Twitter, I've seen, where you've been uploading close-ups of museum skulls, haven't you?
Yes.
What kind of reaction has that been getting?
Yeah, it's been going well. So they're all from... I work at the University Museum of Zoology in Cambridge. So I've just got hundreds of pictures of our specimens and just trying to tell a few of the little stories about them by getting people to guess what a small shot section of them are. I'm doing that kind of every weekday.
Yeah, I won't lie, I have struggled. I've been looking, going, come on, Ryan, you're going to get one in a minute, and nothing. But it turns out, I just don't see that many skulls, apparently, which is, I think, is acceptable. But my first question to you, Jack, is something that I ask everyone that I have on these interview Extra Wild shows, is when did, and I guess how did, your thirst for nature and wildlife begin for you?
I can't really remember a time that I wasn't one of those little nature nerd kids. My mum tells stories of, putting my clothes in the wash and finding that there were regurgitated owl pellets in my pockets and things like that. there's no kind of like epiphany, wow, isn't nature amazing moment for me. It's always there, which is nice.
That's probably the best thing I've ever heard be found in a person's pocket. It's certainly the least worrying.
Sorry?
Well, I guess someone growing up and a mother finding something in a son's pocket, I mean, a regurgitated owl pellet is probably up there with the least concerning. Especially where I grew up in Bracknell, Jack. That's cool. So it's kind of like you said, it's something that I say as well, is that, like, it's trying to remember that time where I wasn't. Is there something specific as a kid or a type of animal that really got your interest going?
I'm not sure there is. I've always been more into mammals than anything else. Mm. My mum's a biology teacher. She's mostly into plants and actually like mammals very much. But I remember going out when we were on little walks around the place. She'd send me on little missions to find, can you find this? Like a little scavenger hunt. I remember doing that, but there's no kind of sudden moment that happened for me.
Oh, right. So is there anyone that kind of, like, because I know for myself, it's like I watched a lot of nature programs and a lot of people on TV. There was obviously Attenborough's Steve Irwin's and things like that. Was there anyone that kind of inspired you as a kid growing up that thought, oh God, I want to do work like that, or that's kind of inspired?
Well, I mean, sure, everyone would say David Attenborough.
Of course, yeah.
proper legend.
Yeah, absolutely. So you specialise in natural history in museums. And I think natural history museums around the world are very popular among people to go to. But one thing I've always considered, and this is, putting myself in the same category, is that I go to them, but I don't always know what I'm going to find, or I don't know what I'm going to learn. I'm kind of an open book. But what kind of things can we actually take away from these collections of specimens at natural history museums? What kind of things can we learn?
So much. There's the science side. So we could look at a skull, for example, and learn so much about how it lived and how it fitted into its environment. Mm. So I would say that there's, you know, two key pillars to natural history. It's looking at animals alive out in their own environments, how they move and how they have adapted to those environments. You get a huge amount of information from seeing them alive, but a completely different set of information will come from seeing them dead in the museum. Mm. And seeing their skulls and things like that. I sometimes say a different answer to this question, but my favourite skull is, at the moment, walrus skulls. I think are absolutely amazing.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And walruses are just brilliant animals, but if it's unclear how they eat and what they eat just from looking at the, looking at a live animal. And obviously hard to study something that lives and feeds at the bottom of the sea in the Arctic.
Yeah.
If you look at their skulls, you can work it out. We know they eat clams, little kind of inch-wide shellfish, and people would assume that the big tusks on a walrus are for raking them up off the seabed, but actually, if you look at their skulls and their tusks, the scratches are on the outside of the tusks rather than the inside if they're being used as rakes, so that means that they're not using them to feed, but what they are doing is using their whiskers. So they have more muscles in their face than any other animal, and their stiff little whiskers pick up these clams and put them in a wedge in the front of their little nook in the front of their jaws, which you can see really clearly on a skull. Mm. And then if you look inside their mouths, and their palates, the roof of their mouth is kind of almost tubular, completely arched, and that matches the shape of their tongues. So their tongues operate as a bit of a kind of sausage piston, where they've got these clams stuck at the front of their mouths in this groove in their solidly locked jaws, and they ram their tongues backwards in their mouths, and that shucks the meat out of the shell, creates a vacuum and just pulls the meat out. So they drop the empty shell, they never swallow the shells, and they just eat these little morsels of clam meat without having to chew on anything. And you can see that from the skulls, but we can see so many other things, you know, see how they're related to each other. Mm. And we can answer questions from museum specimens that when people collected them, they just had no idea that, you know, those questions were arrived. So we can sample chemicals on their skin. So there was a study a few years ago of bird skins in natural history museums in North America that were just sampling for air pollution on their feathers. So they found out kind of a 100-year history of what the air was like in North America.
Jesus.
From looking at museum specimens, which is really useful. We can, these days, we can CT scan them. So we've got a big study going on at the University Museum of Zoology in Cambridge, where I work, where a team are CT scanning wet specimens, which is basically like dissecting them without actually using a scalpel, so we can see where all of their bones fit inside their bodies. Mm. Don't cause damage to the specimens, and therefore they're studying, you know, the evolution of how the spine came to be. Of course, you know, genetic samples can be taken to museums. No one knew about so long ago. So there's so much, and then from I could keep going. I've written a book about this.
This is so interesting. I can't believe some of this.
Kind of conservation story. So, not only is the physical specimen itself important, but the, you know, the label that goes with it. So we can look at an animal's, a specimen's label, and it will say it was collected on this day in this location. Mm. And that's proving incredibly important now to work out how species populations and ranges have changed over time, particularly around questions about climate change and other big biodiversity loss questions, so we can see how things are moving, and how that can inform conservation.
Wow, that's.
Go
for
it. Another part of your question, you said you go into the museums and you don't really know what you're looking at. So what I just talked about there is kind of the collections behind the scenes, but the museums themselves, the display, the galleries, so what we see on display is also a really interesting way of thinking about things, because we might think of museums as kind of quite scientific or very scientific places that are just there to present facts, but the facts that we see and the way that we see them presented are not always necessarily particularly scientifically thought out, so that what I'm saying is, I guess museums are quite biased in the way they present nature. Mm. So there are political and social biases that we see in museum galleries that may reflect the times at which specimens were collected. So there's a, you know, there's a real historical as well as scientific angle to these museums. So we can see that, for example, there are many more male specimens on display than female specimens. Wow. And for certain groups, particularly birds, those males are displayed in ways that reflect human social biases. So, you know, they are kind of all puffed up and in a domineering pose, with the females kind of bowing down below them, which may have absolutely nothing to do with their natural history. It's not behaviours they do in the world. It's just the male taxidermists, of those of your kind of imposing their own social views on these on these birds. So.
The patriarchy exists in the Natural History Museum's displays as well.
Exactly, the birds are helping to prop up the patriarchy.
Wow, that's incredible. That was all so interesting. I mean, going from the walruses, I can't believe how much you can tell from the skull, seeing from relationship, or like you said, kind of which were related to what, or kind of how they eat and stuff like that. That's incredible to be able to tell all that just from one part of the body.
Yeah, I mean, all museums are brilliant, but the Natural History Museums are the only ones that can help us kind of answer the big questions about life and how we might exist in it.
And the air pollution as well. That has literally kind of like got me a bit speechless there, because I didn't even think. Obviously, like I said, most countries I go to where there is a natural history museum, I'll pop in, and not once has it ever I don't know why it would, but I wouldn't think that. Oh, maybe you could, you know, test the air from back, you know, 100, 150 years ago. That's incredible as well. That must be huge, reliable data.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, people often think, or say, why do you need 50 of these same animals? And it's because they're collected over time series. So they produce these incredibly valuable data sets where we can look at the same thing at different points in time over the 200 plus years that many museums have been going. So it's, yeah, there's questions, as I say, people haven't thought of when they were first collected.
Yeah, absolutely. It's incredible. It's going to make me look at specimens in a much different light now when I go in. I also can't believe that walruses just eat clams and are that big, because when I first saw one, I was like, how the hell are they that big?
Everywhere there are absolutely giant animals that
eat this tiny bit of food.
Tiny thing.
As with most marine mammals, anyway. But so we mentioned when we spoke planning this that you're a fan of Australian mammals. What is it about the Australian mammals that you love so much?
Well, a couple of things. Like, firstly, I like an underdog, and Australian mammals get a bit of a hard time of it. People describe them as primitive or kind of evolutionary throwbacks, it doesn't make any scientific sense. It's not true. And Australian mammals do absolutely amazing things. And I spend a lot of time there. And you can travel for 100 or 200 kilometres from one place to another and just see a completely different set of animals in one place than you did from the other. It's incredibly diverse, and also super threatened. And so I think there are many, many misconceptions about Australian mammals. I'm kind of trying to set those things right.
Could you, I'm sorry if this is putting you on the spot, feel free to say absolutely not, but there's a few I've read recently, rightly or wrongly, about the koala. There's a lot of issues people have with the koala in regards to its survival skills, a bit like, I guess, the panda with the food it eats and the fact it is not, well, from what I read, not overly built to survive. Can you debunk any of that? How good is the koala?
It's one of those questions that if you try and unpick it, it doesn't really stand up to much scrutiny. Koalas were doing fine for a very long time, much like pretty much any other medium-sized mammal you could pick. And then when humans change the environment significantly, then they suffer pretty dramatically. I mean, there is something to be said if you walk around Australia during, I don't know, like when it's raining really heavily, and you look up and you just see it. So they're the largest arboreal tree living animal in Australia. They're too big for tree holes. They're just kind of sat in the wedge of two branches, looking absolutely miserable. But that doesn't mean they're not evolutionary fit. If we go around cutting all their trees down, having environments where fire's taking over, then they are. It's not their fault that they are then crashing in terms of numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was going to ask if you have a favourite, but then you have already said that you've been writing a book about platypuses. Are they going to be up there with one of your favourite?
They are. I have been for many years the number one best animal in the world, and that is a scientific fact.
I now know what to title this episode.
Yeah, like they are incredible. Again, they're one of these animals that people would say they are primitive, but as I said, it doesn't make no living species can be primitive. They're absolutely incredible. They've got this real mix of different features that are seen across other groups that no other animals have. These combinations of attributes, so platypuses, as well as their relatives, the echidnas, lay eggs, as a lot of people know. They are the only mammals to do so. They produce milk without nipples, just kind of oozes out on their skin, which caused a lot of kind of controversy when they were first discovered, because no animals had been known to produce both milk and eggs. So it was a real controversy whether platypuses could lay eggs, but they certainly can. And this lack of nipples thing is quite interesting today, because nipples are a sterile delivery device from getting milk from the mother into the baby. So they're not contaminated by the outside world, but because platypuses and echidnas don't have them, they have to find a different way of sterilizing their milk. So it's got really strong antibacterial properties. Oh, wow. In it, because the babies just lick it up off of the fur.
Yeah.
And so now that's being studied to try to treat hospital superbugs, which is pretty cool, I think.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing.
Platypuses are the only mammals that can detect electricity. So they hunt with their eyes and ears closed underwater, sensing the electrical impulses given off by the worms and insect larvae and crustaceans that they eat, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Echidnas can do it, but only to a small extent, and the only other mammals known to do it is one species of dolphin, Guyana dolphin, so they're kind of unique in that respect.
Yeah, absolutely.
Platypus is also the only mammals that can detect, one of the only mammals that produces venom. So the males have spurs on their ankles that they use for fighting between themselves over mates, and there are very few mammals that produce venom, and they're the only ones that do it seasonally. Amazing things.
Yeah, absolutely. That's incredible. How dangerous or how toxic is the venom that the platypus has? Is it a risk to like humans or larger mammals?
So it's mainly used between platypuses, but they do use it in defence. And there are a number of human stories of being stung by a platypus, and it is said to be one of the worst things to be injected with. That they are excruciating pain that can last for weeks, and the biological effects can last for months, if not years. There's one guy who was stung who was called Keith Payne, which I think is perfect, who continued to have reduced mobility in his hand
for
15 years.
What?
After being stung. It has these incredible toxicological effects that cannot be abated with traditional painkillers. Don't go around grabbing male platypuses during the breeding season.
Oh my god, what a story. I mean, what a way to go, though. Like, can you imagine, like, you'd have to...
One's ever died, as far as we know, no one's ever died from platypus venom.
But I mean, I'm sure Keith changed the story slightly. You'd have to in the pub, wouldn't you? I wouldn't be able to sit there and be like, it was a platypus. People would be like, what? I would have to change the story. It was a big platypus. That would be my story. that's incredible. I didn't know about them being able to detect the electrical impulses. That's amazing, because that's a real kind of, top predator kind of thing, really, when we look at other animals that can sense different kind of senses in the water. That's a real apex predator thing. I didn't know they were able to do
it. Yeah, sharks do it.
Yeah.
Famed for their predatory skills.
Yeah, absolutely. That's incredible. The other animal I promised that we would chat about was the wombat. You have a love for the wombats.
I do, and I have to admit that it's slightly less scientific for why I think wombats are awesome, to why I think platypuses are awesome. It's just, they are a delight. They're just, they bumble around. They take quite they appear to take life kind of as it comes. You know, they're quite easy to hang out with in certain places. In Australia where you find them, and they just move with this kind of bump to bump, bump theme tune. I reckon going around their heads.
Just being followed by a tuba.
I mean, they've got cool biology as well. You know, they've got ever growing teeth like rodents do. Mm. So they continue to grind down their teeth on the tough vegetation that they eat. They're amazing burrowers. They can burrow for kind of, I think 30 metres is the longest known burrow of a wombat. They can allegedly squish. They've got really, really massive bums that stick out well beyond their legs. And there are a number of reports of dogs' skulls being crushed by the backside of a wombat against the roof of their burrow as the dogs chase them in.
Oh my God.
Excellent anti-predatory defences. But mostly I just like them because they look sweet.
They're adorable. I now love the fact there is nothing in Australia that isn't at some point potentially dangerous.
Well, that's true. I reject that because I think Australia, sure, has dangerous snakes and dangerous spiders, but so does pretty much everywhere else.
True.
And what Australia doesn't have is much in the way of large predators. So, you know, I think tens of thousands of people are killed by snakes and spiders elsewhere in the world, but only a tiny number of people are killed in Australia. So Australia gets tarred with this brush of a dangerous place, but compared to everywhere else, it doesn't have the whole range of dangerous animals.
Yeah, that's a very true point. I've never considered that, actually, from a predator point of view. That's very true. That's very true. And I also do like the fact that it came down to the wombat, and you're like, oh, they're just cute. But like, you did say some other things, but that was a great answer to give. I wanted to go on this point, and I know a lot of stuff at the moment is kind of, it's hard to measure because of COVID and everything going on, but I do like to keep this chat going in regards to Australia, because I think it is very important to be kept in shows like this. The fires in Australia recently, they were like truly devastating. What kind of impact realistically is this going to have on flora and fauna in Australia for the next coming years?
I guess there's no real way to be too positive about this story. It's bad, you know. And as you say, we don't quite know what is happening, because as soon as the fires died down, or very soon after the COVID lockdown started, so we are losing the opportunity to go in and monitor what's happened to these species across a huge range of Australia, and also to implement vital conservation measures. But it's, as I say, it's going to be bad. So there are maybe 20, well, a lot of studies have said during the fires there were between 20 and 100 species that were already endangered that had most of their known range burnt during the last phase of fire. So there, it is inevitable that there will be a number of extinctions as a result, or this being the final blow, just because of how widespread and thorough and hot the fires are. So, yeah, for a lot of species, there's everywhere that they're known to live has burnt. Obviously, some animals would have been killed by the flames themselves, but even if they did manage to shelter, then when the fires have gone, there's nothing to eat. It's very dry. There's the water is completely ash-ridden, and the shelter. And then cats come in. So cats are known to follow fire to kind of mop up any animals that have managed to survive after it. So, it's not a good situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of like you said, it's not to, not for either of us to sound too depressing on the situation, but it is kind of a very real thing, I think, that's going on. And obviously with COVID around the world, there's impact on everything. And obviously wildlife conservation is a huge one that it is having an impact on, with not being able to get out and about to just get data as well. But it is, I remember just seeing it thinking, God, this is going to have huge impacts on the country, having travelled Australia myself and just seeing how delicate a lot of it is, and just seeing how quickly it was being engulfed was quite shocking. But that's I mean, It is a very real way of putting it, I guess. Yeah, there was already a lot of endangered animals out there, but didn't need that.
No, I mean, there are, you know, it's not all bad. I mean, it's bad, but it's not. There are some positive things to say. So one of the animals which the entire range was burnt for is the Kangaroo Island Dunart, which is a small rat-sized marsupial carnivore, which they can eat lizards and invertebrates. Really, really wonderful little marsupial. Everywhere that it was known, it was endangered already. Everywhere that it was known to live was burnt. But very quickly, conservationists on Kangaroo Island, as soon as they could get back in, started monitoring it and found a new site for where they lived, and fenced it essentially and got all the cats out, produced little cat fruit-proof tunnels leading into it and between different pockets of unburnt vegetation. So it was a great immediate crowdfunding campaign. I think they asked for something like $10,000 and got hundreds of thousands to kind of immediately step up. So there are good things did happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's good to know. It's the quick acting, I guess, isn't it? Quick thinking, quick acting, and just getting out there before things get worse and worse. My last question to you, which is again a question that I ask everyone that I have on the show, is that if you could pass on one bit of advice to, I say the generation of today, I always say that, but I mean kind of everyone, because I don't think it is just on the generation of today, in regards to what to the natural world, what would you pass on to everyone?
I'd say remember that what you see today isn't the baseline. Today isn't normal. It's very easy for people to think, oh, when I was younger, there were so many of these things around, and now there's fewer than that, or more than that, in certain places. Yeah. It's important to know that actually, even whatever, 15, 20 years ago, that wasn't normal either. If we want to look at what the baseline is, it's probably 200 years back. So it's to try and think beyond your own lifetimes in terms of change, which is probably quite a bad message, because that message is basically things are worse than even you think they are. So maybe I should have a positive one. How about listen to bushes. I'm spending my kind of prescribed exercise hour in lockdown at the moment. There's a woodland near my house, so I just go and walk very slowly through this woodland and stop at bramble patches and just listen, because invariably you'll hear the voles and shrews, which are incredibly common British mammals, going about their business in there. And I know that most people just walk past it and they're not hearing these rustles, but they're very easy to find, and it kind of brings a little bit of joy to my life. So listen to bushes, maybe that's the positive.
Yeah, I like we've got two messages in there, and it was given in the right order. No, that was really good. Listen, Jack, this has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for spending the time on the show. Enjoy the rest of your time in lockdown. I hope it's all been positive for you and remains to be as positive as it can be.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, hopefully chat again soon.
Yeah, nice to talk to you. Thanks, man.
Thanks again for tuning in to Into the Wild. If you'd like to keep up to date with the projects and shows that Jack is working on, you can do so on Twitter at Jack D. Ashby. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes and Twitter and leave us a review. You can also get in touch on social media at Into the Wild Pod. Until next time, keep well, stay safe, and live the good life.